You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is Dr. Leah Wiggum. Dr. Wiggum has been with us before, and she works for the Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living. You probably, if you had an apple this week, you're going to think about them because you may have had an apple courtesy of them. But Leah, thank you so much for being with us here today. And if you don't mind, because it's been a while since we had you on the show, and you were talking a little bit about your background. First of all, I was intrigued when you said you work for the USDA as a human nutrition research analyst for that center. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Thank you for having me today. I was a research scientist with the USDA at a human nutrition research center, and I led a research team that studied various aspects of obesity.
I just read a book. I can't remember the name of the book. And it's interesting because it said there used to be articles and news stories about people dying from starvation, from malnutrition. And now it's the opposite. We have stories about people who are dying from overeating and obesity.
That's true. We do have high levels of obesity and overweight in our country, and this is spreading throughout the world. In the U.S., approximately two-thirds of adults are either overweight or obese, and rates in children are also increasing. So there are a lot of scientists studying this disease. It is a chronic disease, obesity. It's not a matter of lifestyle choice. That's often a misconception that people are just too lazy to get out and exercise or too lazy to eat a healthy diet. But it's not about willpower or self-discipline. There's over 100 contributing causes of obesity, and we're starting to understand more and more about those various causes. And we know that to treat obesity and to prevent obesity is going to take a complex approach that factors in many different tools because the causes are so varied.
I'm glad that you mentioned the fact that, you know, there are so many causes because sometimes we have the negative stereotype of them, not realizing that perhaps one of the things that they could be wrong is maybe their thyroid. Something is wrong with the thyroid or perhaps some other kind of disease. And when you mentioned there are 100 contributing factors, people may be at home wondering, what? What are 100? My first ones are overeating, no exercise, but what are the 98 others?
The reasons why a person overeats or doesn't exercise can be completely out of their control as well. So that's another thing to keep in mind is that ultimately obesity is a condition of too many calories being stored in the body, but that process can be very different for different people. So keeping that in mind is really important. Bias against people with obesity is really high. It's one of the highest levels of bias and stigma we have in our society, and one that is still very accepted among the population, unfortunately. It's not considered very appropriate to be racially biased or gender biased. A lot of those biases are more kind of undercover. But people with obesity deal with a lot of right-in-their-face bias and stigma. People will come right up to them on the street, give them weight loss advice, criticize how they're raising their children. I mean, the stories are endless. People with obesity are in a compromised position oftentimes when it comes to hiring, when it comes to social interactions. Studies have shown that they earn less money, and all of these things contribute to the pressures that can make the disease burden even worse. If they face bias when they go to their healthcare provider, for example, they're much less likely to go back, and then they're not getting the medical treatment that they need to help them be as healthy as they can, regardless of their weight, or to potentially address their weight and use the tools necessary to attain a healthier weight. So it's really a problem in our society.
One of the things that was brought up to me, I think a couple of months ago, and I said, well, I've never thought of that. The fact that because we live in such a politically correct world, that it's almost wrong to tell somebody that they're overweight. So with that in mind, are we hurting our children by saying it's okay to be that way? Or how do we go about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Dealing with obesity in children is very tricky because in children, they still need to have adequate nutrition and adequate calories to grow. And so the approach for addressing obesity in children needs to be different than it is in adults. To address obesity in children, it needs to be a whole family approach. And oftentimes there are changes that the whole family can make to help support a healthier environment for that child. And some of our other tools that are available to address obesity aren't appropriate in children. So the approach that needs to be taken by clinical experts in pediatric obesity is different than the approach that would be taken with adults. But with adults, there's multiple tools that are available, and oftentimes our healthcare providers and other members of the healthcare team are not adequately trained, just haven't had the opportunity to learn how to best apply those tools. Our institute, the Institute for Healthy Living at UTEP, will be bringing a special training program to El Paso, most likely early next year, that will train a cohort of healthcare providers in obesity medicine and weight management. And I'm really excited about that because it's going to address the team-based approach to weight management. You can't have a single healthcare provider who can do everything, and those providers are not trained to do everything. But you really need a team, you know, a person like a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant who knows how to do the medical management. But you also need a dietitian who knows how to do the nutrition counseling. And you need an exercise physiologist because the exercise approach in a person with obesity is different from a person without obesity. And if that person hasn't been trained in how to prescribe exercise appropriately for a person with obesity, then it can cause more harm than good. Sometimes you may need a social worker or a behavioral psychologist who can also be part of that team. And it really depends on the type of obesity that that person is dealing with. But each approach for each patient is unique and tailored to that patient, but it requires a team-based approach. And so we are going to bring this training opportunity to El Paso to help build a cohort of providers who can work together to address obesity in patients here in our region.
We are visiting with Dr. Leah Wiggum. Dr. Wiggum is the executive director of the El Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living. And if you wouldn't mind sharing with us, in a nutshell, what you all do at the Institute for Healthy Living, and then we'll break it down from there.
Sure. At the Institute for Healthy Living here at UTEP, we have, you can think of what we do in sort of three main categories, and oftentimes that work is overlapping. But we have one area where we are working with community partners to collect data to evaluate programs that they are doing or to conduct research in new approaches related to increasing healthy eating and active living. So everything we do focuses in some respect on healthy eating or active living. So we have a research and evaluation arm to the work we do, and all of that work is out in the community. We cover a region that includes three counties in southern New Mexico, two counties in West Texas, and we work in Mexico as well. And then another component of what we do is from the policy side. So we work with different coalitions throughout the region. In some cases, we are building new coalitions where we see there's a need to bring people together with common goals to work towards a specific policy or programmatic approach. And in other cases, we're providing support for existing coalitions. And then a third component that we do is either program development or program identification. So oftentimes in the work we're doing in the communities, we learn that there's a need for a particular kind of programmatic approach to help increase healthy eating or active living. And if we're aware that that program already exists, we will help to bring that program to the region and help get it implemented working with our community partners. If we feel that there's not a sufficient evidence-based approach already developed then we work to develop that approach ourselves.
At the beginning of the program, we mentioned the fact that if you had an apple on Tuesday, you probably got it as a result of what your initiative is doing. But tell us a little bit about, you know, what went behind this Apple Crunch Day.
Well, Apple Crunch Day is a national event that is part of National Food Day. And through some of the coalition work that we've been doing, there's an organization called El Paso True Food here in El Paso who has been promoting Apple Crunch Day for the last few years through programs at the local library. And they have it during this week in October because that's when National Food Day is. And the idea behind Apple Crunch Day is to encourage people to eat an apple in support of healthy, affordable, nutritious, locally grown food. And there's a lot of reasons why we want to encourage more locally grown food. It gets to us oftentimes with more nutrients because it's a shorter time from when it's been picked. It helps to support our local economy because the money is going right back to the farmers who live and work in our community. And by having locally grown fruits and vegetables, for example, it's a more sustainable, resilient source of food for us. If we rely on all of our fruits and vegetables to be shipped from someplace like California or Mexico, if some disaster happens and that source of food is no longer available, then we're in a really tight spot here in our region if we don't have some locally grown food. So by ensuring that we have a strong local food system, it makes our community and our region more sustainable and more resilient. So Apple Crunch Day is about supporting all those ideas and encouraging people to think about buying their food locally when it's available, eating a healthy diet, because healthy diets help people to prevent all sorts of chronic diseases, including obesity, but also things like diabetes and cancer and other chronic diseases. Healthy diets can help people have a higher quality of life and live a longer life as well. So that's what Apple Crunch Day is about. And one of our coalition partners, El Paso True Food, who is part of a new coalition called the Local Food Promotion Coalition, asked if the Institute for Healthy Living would help to promote Apple Crunch Day this year. And we partnered with Big Eight Supermarkets, and they provided over 1,000 apples for distribution at UTEP. So UTEP got behind us this year in helping to promote the Apple Crunch Day as well. So we were over in Leech Grove yesterday handing out apples to students as they passed between classes. We encouraged different departments to take pictures of themselves eating apples and post them on Facebook. And if any listeners would still like to participate in this, it's not too late. You can, for the next month or so, feel free to take a picture of you eating an apple, post it on social media with the hashtag Apple Crunch Day UTEP, all one word, or Apple Crunch Day PDN for Paso del Norte. So if you're not part of UTEP and you want to post for part of the region, that's fine as well. We had EPISD participating this year, Las Cruces Public Schools, Isleta Independent School District. So we had a lot of kids and a lot of schools throughout the region participating in Apple Crunch Day as well. And then, as you saw, a lot of people here on campus eating apples too.
And the video that I saw on social media, the fact that, you know, you were at Leech Grove, and did you have any people who maybe were a little bit hesitant, like, why are you doing this?
We had a few people say, what's the catch? I guess it seemed too good to be true that we'd be giving out a free apple. So we do really appreciate that Lowe's supported us in that, in providing those apples so that we could do that. Some people just said they weren't interested in the apples, but when we explained why we were doing it, almost everyone took an apple and took a picture and hopefully got it posted to social media.
So there are a lot of pictures of students with apples out there, and
yes,
and also administrators, because you had Dr. Antalicio do it as well.
That's right. That's right. University Communications worked with us to get a video made and all sorts of fun pictures posted early in the week.
October is also a month where we think about breast cancer awareness, but there are just so many things that are happening locally. Tell us a little bit about what the Institute is doing the rest of this month and going into perhaps the rest of the fall.
Sure. Well, we have a couple of policy-based initiatives that we're working on right now. One is related to healthy food financing. This is a national evidence-based approach that's been implemented in many communities. one of our coalition partners that's centered out of Las Cruces, the Mesilla Valley Food Policy Council, has been working toward this goal for over a year now. And now there's some partners here in El Paso County who are also becoming interested in this idea of setting up a healthy food financing initiative. The idea behind this is to have funds set aside. Oftentimes it looks different in different communities, but oftentimes these funds are a collection of contributions from county and city governments, sometimes through foundations as well. And those funds get set up to provide low-interest loans to food retailers who want to make changes in their food retail environment so that they can more readily sell healthy and affordable foods. Sometimes, for example, a corner store may be selling snack foods, and maybe for the kids in that neighborhood, that's the only source of food within walking distance of their home. If that corner store could install a refrigerator with glass doors, they could start to sell fresh fruits and vegetables, for example. And so these small, low-interest loans can help food retailers like that install the equipment that they need or make the changes to their stores so that they can better offer low-cost, healthy, affordable, and preferably local foods.
And because I would imagine that in many instances, that is what's holding back that vendor or that proprietor from offering the fresh fruits and vegetables.
That's right. Sometimes it can take just a small investment to make a change like that, but the food retail business is a very tight profit margin business. So it's hard for them to have loss of sales because part of their store is under construction, or to make investments in equipment because the profit margins are so tight to begin with. So to stay competitive and make these changes, these kinds of programs can often be helpful. They can also help build whole new stores. So when there are areas that are considered food deserts where there just are not food retail options available, these kinds of financing programs can help to support building a new grocery store. And what shape that would take in our county, we don't know yet. But we do have both kinds of environments in El Paso County, in Hudspeth County, and up in New Mexico, in all of these areas where we work, that we've got some places where the retail environment exists, but the food being sold is not, does not include healthy options. And then we've got more rural areas where there just aren't enough retail locations. By definition, the USDA defines a food desert if, when you're living in a rural location, you're more than 10 miles from a grocery store or supermarket, and in an urban location, if you're more than a mile from a grocery store or supermarket.
That's quite a difference.
Yes. The assumption is if you're living rurally, you're going to have a car and you're going to have to use that car to get to food. In an urban location, ideally, people would have access to healthy, affordable food at a grocery store or a supermarket without needing to use a personal vehicle and be able to use public transportation, even walk. So that's why 1 mile is set as the definition for an urban area.
It's becoming, in many instances, trendy to eat healthy. But sometimes that trendiness can have a negative effect because people want to go to the Whole Foods, the Sprouts, one of those stores. And then there are the people who would like to eat healthy like that, but they can't afford to go to some of these stores. And so does that trendiness kind of put a division line as far as offering nutrition to the consumer?
It oftentimes confuses people, but it's not a realistic barrier, meaning that it is possible to eat healthy and affordably, but oftentimes people get confused or have the misconception that they can't eat healthy and afford it. Affordability is a real problem. In our county, 1 in 4 children live in a food insecure home, and that means at some time during a month, their family is not able to buy the food that they need to eat. So 1 in 4 kids lives in a food insecure home. So affordability of food is a real problem. Another area of activity that we're involved with right now is partnering with local school lunch programs to ensure that we're optimizing how many kids participate in the school breakfast and lunch programs. And in some cases, schools are even serving dinner after school. And if we can get more kids eating through those programs at their schools, that takes some of the pressure off the families to purchase some of that food. And we know that the school lunch programs are serving healthy food because they're part of a federal program that has nutrition standards. So in many cases, the food served by our school lunch programs throughout the region is healthier than what we may be serving at home to our own kids. They have access to food retailers who specially design foods to meet these nutrition standards. So sometimes they may be, you know, as a parent, you may say, well, my kid had pizza at school today. Pizza's not healthy. Well, I can tell you if they're having pizza at their school, it's whole grain crust, it's lower fat, it's lower sodium, and it's got an appropriate amount of protein for the child. So those foods are available because these retailers that serve these food wholesalers that serve those school lunch programs have to meet those federal guidelines for nutrition. So our school lunch programs can serve fabulously healthy foods, and we're working with them to find more ways to get more kids participating in those school lunch programs to address just this, the fact that so many kids in our region do come from homes where they don't have enough money to buy food.
And it seems like, well, I think we were all probably part of it, where we get lunch money or we have a lunch that we take to school. But come lunchtime, we leave campus, we have a soda pop, mm-hmm. bag of Cheetos or something else, and that's our lunch. And I mean, for a teenager, I guess that's okay to them, but they're not realizing what they're missing, what they're not getting. Do you all have programs where you teach people about reading labels, about what a serving size is? Because, you know, when you go to get a big gulp, it says, you know, serving size, mm-hmm. five people or whatever.
Right.
And we end up drinking it by ourselves. So how important is that? And is it hard to get that across to families and children, students?
Well, one of the nice things about the school lunch program is you don't have to know how to read a label. You'll know that the meal you're getting as part of your school lunch program is healthy because it's designed through the federal program to meet those guidelines. There are programs available in the region. We've been working with local food retailers to provide a program that gets taught right in grocery stores, for example, to help people understand how to select and prepare healthy foods. But we are working with local school districts to address this concept of open campus at lunchtime that you're talking about, because it's not just about the food options that those kids are facing. We know from data collected nationally that kids who leave campus at lunchtime are more likely to get into car accidents, more likely to be struck by a car as a pedestrian, more likely to use alcohol, more likely to smoke, more likely to use drugs, more likely to be absent from class in the afternoons. Teen pregnancy rates are higher, and the nutrition is compromised. We know the cost of the food off campus is much higher. So kids who eat on campus, a high school lunch typically costs less than $2. A fast food lunch, if you have a burger, fries, and a drink, is about $6 in our region. So that's a big difference. The nutrition is less and the cost is higher. So that's a real problem to have that open campus option for children when it comes to multiple aspects. But we want them to enjoy their lunch and to enjoy that social time. So there are schools that are working on ways to make staying on campus more fun for kids and more entertaining. I know Franklin High School has some new programming that they've developed. They got a grant recently to beautify their courtyard. So they've been working really hard to encourage kids to stay on campus, regardless of what the policy is. And it looks like that's working to get the kids more interested. They're adding a salad bar. They added a frozen yogurt machine and some other fun things that keep the kids more engaged in having lunch on campus.
As we go to our local pharmacies, drugstores, doctors, you're starting to see that it's flu season coming up, so people are getting their flu shots. But there's a lot more than just getting that shot as far as staying healthy. And what you've been talking about so far is very important as well. Eating healthy, make sure that you stay, as one of my people, a friend, should say, vitaminized. What are some of the things that, and I know, I think you wrote an article on how to stay healthy in the winter.
Healthy during the school year. In the recent El Paso Inc. Kids Inc. issue that came out this fall, I contributed an article, and we talked about three main components of staying healthy during the school year. There's the nutrition component, everything we've been talking about. The aspect of physical activity. So being physically active helps you stay healthier. It helps you sleep better. It improves your immune function. And it helps kids think better in school. So studies have shown that when kids are physically active, they do better. For example, if they walk for just 20 minutes before taking a test versus sit for 20 minutes, their brain activity is higher and they do better on that test. So we want to make sure our kids stay physically active, not just for the physical benefits, but for the mental and intellectual benefits as well. And a third big component that people often forget is sleep. And sleep is so key to keeping us healthy, because a body that is well rested can then regulate all those other aspects. It's hard to be physically active and eat healthy if you're sleep deprived, because your hormone, your endocrine system shifts and drives your body towards unhealthy eating habits and makes you more lethargic and less likely to want to be physically active. So we want to really help people keep in mind that going to bed at about the same time every night, for adults, getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep. For most kids, they need closer to 10 to 12 hours of sleep.
And because that really throws off people, especially students, who they'll be on a certain schedule and then all of a sudden they stay up till 3 or 4 in the morning studying and they're not ready for that test that
right.
next day.
They'll probably do much better on that test if they get to sleep by 10 o'clock and get a good night's sleep. By staying physically active, they'll get better quality sleep. And by having a healthy diet, they'll get better quality sleep. All those things interconnect. So that's why that article that I wrote really talks about how those three components all work together and how parents need those three components as well. So working collectively as a family, if the parents stay up late and don't get much sleep, that's a bad example for the kids. And so just really emphasizing how the whole family can work together to have healthy meals together in the evenings, sit down, keep them stress-free, enjoy each other, talk to each other, have a regular sleep pattern that is adequate numbers of hours of sleep at night, and to ensure to engage healthy eating habits throughout the week as well.
One last question, Leah, that this is something that I think a lot of people look to as a super pill, and that is coffee and energy drinks in case they stayed up till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Using caffeine as a way to stimulate yourself in place of sleep is not a healthy habit. There's nothing inherently wrong with coffee by itself. Studies have shown that 1 or 2 cups a day for most people is fine. This is in adults. I wouldn't encourage it in children. But using those energy drinks and so forth is not a great idea. Those are not heavily regulated, and sometimes they can have effects on people's bodies that can be pretty negative and even somewhat scary. So those are things that we certainly don't want to encourage people to abuse or to try and use in place of sleep.
Thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been visiting with Dr. Leah Wiggum. Dr. Wiggum is the executive director for the Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living. If you want to find out more information about what we've been talking about, you can go to their website, and that is PDNIFHL.
IHL.
And it's, again, Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living. If you type that in Google, I'm sure it'll find it. But there are various tabs that you can find there on their webpage, including the article that Leah was describing a little while ago. Again, thank you very much for being with us here.
Thank you for having me.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTAP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.